Attention listeners, ahead are spoilers.
Hello, and welcome to the Movie Trap. My name is Russell Carlson, and with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Chris Boroff.
I would like to leave this house immediately.
And with me, as always, Zach Powers.
His house in the middle of the sea.
His house is a very, very, very fine house.
I think that's the line at the end of that song.
Anyway, on the Movie Trap, normally, one of the three hosts you just met picks a theme, and then each of us pick a movie based on that theme. After we've watched all three movies, we vote for our favorites using an allocated amount of points, plus some bonus points we earn along the way. Whichever movie wins the vote, that host gets to pick the next theme. However, I wrote all of that and prepped myself and really worked hard at getting that intro down. But for this episode, it doesn't fucking matter because this is the bonus Halloween episode, which I believe will be released actually on Halloween now that we're new release schedule is on
Sunday. It's the spooky day
Sunday.
Itself. I hope you're all in a cornfield being chased by a monster while you're listening to this.
I hope you're all sitting around a haunted pumpkin pie telling stories of the days of cornucopias.
The pie is haunted.
Pumpkin
yes.
pie?
The pie is haunted.
Pumpkin yes. pie?
Yeah. It, don't you know? That's what happens to the great pumpkin. It turns into a pie, and then it's just a long-running series of
the plot.
It's a franchise.
Okay.
This is a plot of American Pie 5, American Halloween.
I was about to say the Great American Pumpkin. I thought it was like the Charlie Brown pumpkin, and then like you know, Linus comes in with his blanket and says, "The power of Christ compels you to the haunted pumpkin pie." Anyway, all of that is not what we're watching. What we watch this episode particularly is a reward episode or a bonus episode for our very own Zach Powers.
Depending on the movie. Sometimes
yeah, depending on the movie. Yeah,
sometimes
the
movie. It's a reward.
Sometimes it's a trap. But actually this one was very much a reward. So anyway, how we got here was we did our spooky theme of horror movies from before and including 1959, to which Zach won with Diabolik, and he got to pick the bonus episode as a reward for winning the Halloween Spooktacular, and he has chosen 2020's His House.
Yes, appropriately, because as our Halloween trio was not the spookiest trio of movies.
Correct.
So
yeah.
It's
correct.
Good to get something a little...
Correct.
Something that is actually on the board correctly as a scary movie.
Correct.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. This was spooks were promised and spooks were delivered. So it was actually kind of nice to do this. So because it's a bonus episode, there's no points. There's no voting. We're all trapped in His House. So Zach, why don't you tell us what is His House?
His House, as mentioned, is a 2020 horror film. It is the directorial debut of Remy Weeks. And it is based on a short story, I believe, but I could not find the short story. Anyway, it stars Wenmu Mosaku, Sopi Dirisu, and Matt Smith. It was released last October on Netflix, though it got very little acclaim. We can talk about that later. His House opens with a boat full of refugees crossing the ocean. Several of them are flung from the boat and into the water, after which we cut to a detention center, a holding center in England, where Bull and Raoul, our two protagonists, a man and a woman, are waiting to see what the government of the UK will do with them functionally. Deport them, let them give them refugee status. It's unclear. They go before
I'm scared already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Truly the horrors of the immigration system are perhaps the scariest thing in the film. They go before a board who says they are giving them sort of conditional refugee status. If they can prove themselves to be one of the good ones, they're given an extremely small stipend. They can't work. They can't do all this. Like, they basically can't do anything except sit around in their house and get $75 a week or something to survive on.
They've essentially been set up in a purgatory that there's no clear exit. It's just, you're going to be in this house until we decide that you're okay to stay.
Yeah, pretty much. So they get sent to this house, and it's kind of a shithole, but it's not the best. But on the plus side, they are told normally they'd have multiple groups, multiple families in this house. But for this couple, it's just going to be the two of them alone in this fairly moderately sized house. It has nothing else going for it aside from that. So they are sort of not extremely welcome. Like, their neighbors are sort of weird and or aggressive towards them. The agents are like, the people who are helping them, like, even as they move in, are like, this is bigger than my house. They're like weirdly, I don't know, aggressive and jealous.
It's all got that. It's very much that thing of like, you should be happy you're even getting this, is the like exactly. The sort of refrain that keeps coming up. It's really gross and it's very aggressive, and it is probably sets up the sense of dread that works for the rest of the movie. Yeah,
sure. They react somewhat differently. Bull, the man, he sort of goes to a club and sings football songs with people. But Rial is a little more hesitant to acclimate. She prepares dinner and has them sit at the floor without utensils initially for their meal. But Bull is trying to, like, you know, convince her that they need to immigrate. They need to assimilate a little bit more to fit in so that they could stay. At the same time, Rial has this doll that is implied belonged to their daughter. Which she takes a little string off of it and makes it into a necklace. But shortly thereafter, they both begin to see things. They see things moving in the walls. There's a hole in one of their walls, and Bull sees something moving inside of it. And soon he begins to hammer through the wall at different spots, trying to find whatever is living inside their wall. Occasionally you see human looking figures. At one point, a hand comes out and snatches the doll from one of them. And it's clear something is living inside the house, which, has now been, is even in worse shambles than before. Now that there's holes all through the entire like living room wall. Rial eventually puts together that what she believes the evil is an apeth or a night witch. Something that she says in their culture, like, there's once a poor man who stole so he could get a house. But when he got his house, the man he stole from began to live with him as a night witch or an apeth until he repaid what was owed. So it seems to be that they need to repay some kind of debt in order to get rid of this night witch. Bull resists this idea. He burns everything they brought from them with them from their own culture, including the doll, including the necklace. But it doesn't do anything to stop this apeth or whatever it is from attacking them. He sees drowned figures of people who died in the crossing in his house. He sees a young girl with a knife who nearly slits his throat at one point and is clearly intended to be their daughter, Nyagyak. Things begin to deteriorate as he goes more and more off the rails. He goes to the immigration people to say he needs to change where he's living. But it's quickly clear that if doing so would risk their status, their immigration status. If they lodge any complaint, basically there's a pretty good chance they're just going to get deported because they're not grateful enough. They're not one of the good ones, you know, at all. It also becomes clear while he's there that he is His mental health is deteriorating. That becomes clear to the workers. And soon they are talking about having to come to the house to make sure everything is okay. Obviously, not the best thing for them, considering the house is now in shambles, full of holes. But they do indeed come. And there's a heavy implication that this could risk their immigration status. But Riel is actually kind of okay with leaving. She doesn't think that she belongs here. She says they should just go back to Sedan, where they came from. Regardless, the Apeth continues to torture them and offers Bull a deal. He can give him his life in order to restore the life of their daughter who drowned at sea. Bull initially refuses and even goes catatonic for a while, but eventually snaps out of it and tries to lock them both inside the house with no way out. Riel escapes from the house by sort of locking him in a separate room and jumping out the window. And as soon as she exits, she is back in Sudan, in sort of with a great number of women in a classroom in Sudan, old friends of hers. But as things roll forward, it becomes clear this is some kind of illusion or vision. All of these women had been massacred at some point prior to this. Basically, it becomes clear that they need to repay their debt. The women double down, like that they have sinned and they need to repay. Exactly how they've sinned is shortly thereafter revealed when they flashback to, or relive, I guess, as it were, them escaping from Sudan. They're getting on a bus. The bus is overcrowded. They can only take families with children. So Bull grabs a random young girl and says, "I have a child. We have a child," in order to get them on the bus, the last people on the bus. And as they drive away, the child's real mother runs behind the bus screaming for her daughter and is implied to have also been killed. They decide to take care of this young girl to the best of their ability, but nonetheless, she falls overboard while crossing the ocean and dies. They return away from this illusion back to the house, where Bull has decided to take the Apeth's deal. He cuts his own arm to summon it, and summon it he does. It comes for him and begins to try and insert itself into his skin through the wound, basically. Riel initially lets this happen, but eventually decides against it and attacks the creature and slits its throat while it's trying to inhabit Bull. Eventually, the next day, or a few days later, perhaps, the immigration people come by again to inspect the house to find it has been largely repaired. All of the walls have been sort of drywalled up, and it looks in much, much better shape. Bull and Riel seem to be mentally in a much better position. And they even tell Mark, the sort of main immigration officer, that they managed to kill their witch, and have decided to go on living with not only here, but also with the ghosts from their past. And the final shot of the movie is them in their home, surrounded by ghosts, I guess, of the people who perished before them, also inhabiting the home, but seemingly peacefully. And that is his house.
Yeah, I think the most impressive thing about this movie is the runtime. I mean, Zach went through that plot synopsis, and there was a lot going on, but I mean, it's really brief.
It's like 90 minutes. Yeah, it's a short one.
Like it's very economic. Like for the amount it's trying to give at you, it is pretty economic with it. I was impressed with this film.
A lot of it seemed like it was handled pretty well because it was all sort of explained visually. Like they had some scenes of like fairly detailed backstory, but rather than having somebody just talk and explain the backstory, they just showed it. And that's almost always better than having someone sit down and give a long backstory. It is really interesting kind of how it portrays England. And I was kind of thinking about this because we, in the States now, we're having the issue with the Afghan refugees that basically they had to come over. And everybody knows this. Everybody is aware. And I imagine that a lot of those people are going through almost the exact same level of
and sort of being
into the country, where it's like not really welcome.
And it's definitely constant. Like, you'll just a couple weeks ago, there was a story of Haitian refugees being like whipped by Border Patrol. Like, immigration stories in America are not uncommon in the slightest.
Horror stories.
One of the actors in this really impressed me because I was unaware. Her name is Wunmi Mosaku. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but she's the main woman in this. She also, for most people in America, you might recognize her from either like Lovecraft Country or the thing I knew her mostly from, which was Loki. Because in Loki...
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Which is remarkable to me, because in that, she's very intimidating, and she looks like she could break whatever his name is, Loki, in half. But in this one, she's so sort of quiet and sort of meek, and like, not meek, but like, she's a very mild
subservient person.
I wouldn't say subservient. She just seems calmer. Well, not as intense.
I think
like she has a very intense personality in this, because she definitely has the thing she wants to have happen one way or another.
Well, sure.
It's more that like she doesn't come across as intense and intimidating as she was in Loki.
Okay, I agree with you about the intimidation thing, but I would say that like it's intense, but the way the movie does the trick on you is you sort of get, you think that she's grieving. You know, that's the intensity that you're kind of getting for that emotion. Cause like Borf's right that like, they don't waste a lot of time. The exposition in the story is told visually. There's one moment where, she's getting interviewed by somebody and like, she can't bring it herself to talk about what happened to this little girl, her daughter. And that's enough, you know, like you don't have to, I didn't need to know more than that, but the way the movie, unseals that envelope at the end, because throughout the whole haunting bit with the witch keeps calling Bull a thief. Mm. And you don't really understand why. And then when that moment happens on the bus, you're like, I fucking get it now. That's awesome. I love it when movies do that to you. That like when there's a twist or whatever and you're like, I didn't see that coming, but you kind of maybe should have put the pieces together as you think about it after the fact. I love movies like this. It's fucking great.
And one more thing about Wunmi. Again, hopefully that's apologies for pronunciation if incorrect. Another reason to like her, when asked her personal heroes, one of the people she listed was Paul Newman, which is, I think, a solid...
Fucking A. Tune in for the next episode, kids. So
yeah, we're just
like, going to
be talking about Carlson's love of Paul Newman. Going to be getting into those Coors.
I am here.
I'm with the rest of them. Not just a good actor, a good person, which is pretty rare.
Unlike one of my other favorites, Cassavetes. Good actor, good director. Can't say he sounded like a nightmare when he was drinking. Which was a lot. But on his house, I think that the performances, because it's so, he's so intense and dedicated on fitting in and not getting kicked out.
Right.
And you get the sense that she's stuck in the past, you know, that like, and you think that's informed by this grief, and then you learn it's informed by something else entirely. It's a survivor's guilt almost.
Yeah.
And the way that that dynamic sort of plays out and then evens out at the end, like is pretty cool, because like, if you think about it, I thought that the real, Zach kind of joked about it, but I think it's kind of true. I think the real scary part of this movie is the asylum refugee system in the West. You know, like, and I find it not accidental that when at the final scene, at the penultimate scene, I should say, when he's injecting himself into Bull, it's this white demon looking thing.
For sure.
So I think it's interesting to use assimilation.
I mean, it almost looks like Matt Smith. Like it almost looks like the guy who's
almost
helping them out when they're there. Yeah.
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 And credit to Matt Smith too. He took a pay cut probably to be in this fucking movie.
Yeah, yeah, but he was good in it. I actually was surprised that I thought that character would be worse than he was. Yeah. Of the people in the immigration system, Matt Smith was by far the most reasonable.
He was ambivalent.
Yeah, that's
it. Was the thing he wasn't as evil and aggressive as the other ones. He just also wasn't particularly helpful.
Yeah, but I also got like severe like white savior vibes from Matt Smith's character. You know, like this is a guy who pats himself on the back for basically doing nothing because the little bit that he does do is better than what they'll get, you know, and that's I kind of got those vibes from Matt. I don't know if he was playing to that, but that's the vibe I got.
I would really want to know like what the actual political backstory is on like where the refugees are from and if it's based off a real thing that is occurring or things like that, because one thing that did jump out at me about this is that it does fall into the trope of showing Africa as one giant hellhole, which like there are some nice areas, there's some areas that have severe problems. I'd be curious as to what that is, because it does like suggest that like them as refugees coming to England, as bad as it is, it's still better than where they came from. And sometimes that is very true, but sometimes that's also like I've noticed there's a trope in America, at least with
immigrants
from South America, when they come here we always like imagine that it's hell. But I know a lot of people that are Hispanic who came here and decided, screw this, I'm going to go back to Mexico where I can have my education paid for.
Sure.
These
people very specifically come from South Sudan. And
which is
in real life, there is a lot of terrible stuff going on in South Sudan.
Yeah, that's I feel like I would agree with you if they weren't that specific about it. Okay. They literally say
if
South
they were
Sudan.
Just like, they're from Africa.
Africa,
yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
But
then
South Sudan has a genuine emergency. And there is a refugee crisis specifically originating from
Europe.
That country.
Yeah, for sure. So like that's why I would agree with you, Borf, but if they're how they get away with it is their specificity with it, and that's that. And you know, you say Sudan, anybody, I mean, everybody's gonna know that place is, it's been bad for a long time, no thanks to anybody else outside of it. But anyway, go ahead, Zach.
I think that but I do agree 100% with Russell that this is for sure like one of the major themes about this is the struggle between assimilation and holding on to your culture in a new environment. And obviously Bull is like very much the one trying to assimilate. I think there's absolutely no question the Apeth literally getting inside of his skin to make him sort of, I mean, I'd say a white man inside of a black skin, like it's this new thing, but it's really, it is explicitly more cultural than that. Rial does come across some black British teenagers who are also quite cruel to her.
Correct. They're African. They're black. That's when they do. That's, I thought that was a very telling thing, that this is more nationalism than it is racism.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, It nationalism kind of gets roped into racism a lot for good reason, but they are different things.
I think it
seems like they're almost treating it as like a hazing, like they're being
good point.
Really rude to the new people, but I guess they feel like they belong there because they have an English accent and have been there for at least a generation or two.
And I think that, I mean, every interaction, even the seemingly benign ones, there's like this underlying sort of, obviously there's things like this creepy neighbor who asks why they don't just leave and stuff like this, but there's also a scene where Bull tries to go to a bar and watch a football match and sing sports songs with the guys, and all the other people in the bar view him as kind of this amusement, like they enjoy the fact that he's doing it, but there's still a clear line where he's not really one of them, he's like this amusing,
it's cute that
outsider,
he's
outsider,
yeah, it's cute that he has like decided that he likes this, yeah, there's
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, and there it's not really teasing, but it is sort of like, oh, look, you know, it thinks it can be people, Yeah. You know, well, it's that kind of sympathy. And
as kind of fucked up as it is to say, that is also one of those things with sports. Like, if you can get people to accept you as, like, also liking their team, that is one of the first steps to get introduced to the rest of the community and get brought in. Like, sure, yeah, people feel so
Look,
strongly
about
sports.
Look, we have three episodes to talk about sports there, buddy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure we'll get to it, and that'll be a whole thing. But yeah, yeah, yeah. I actually really liked that scene. It was like one of the more heartwarming scenes for me, because I was like, oh, he's, I mean, I understand that he wasn't really like considered part of the group yet, but it was still one of those things where they were not being dicks to him. They were being open and accepting, and it seemed like the first time the community might have warmed up a little bit to them.
Well, it also seemed like he kind of warmed to it too. It kind of revealed his dedication to want to assimilate, to desire to have this life for his family. It kind of leaned into that as well. So this movie's very economic. There's not a wasted second in this movie. Sure. I mean, everything is very, very tight. That's why I thought you're both kind of right. It is a heartwarming scene, because it is showing, you know, Bull trying to assimilate and having fun with it. He's having a good time. He doesn't know. Like, he's enjoying himself.
There are not necessarily malevolent. They're just somewhat condescending.
Right. They're not throwing quarters at him and shit, saying, you know, dance anything. You know, like, Zach's kind of right, where there is this kind of, like, almost sideshow aspect to him singing along and stuff. But, you know, it is sort of like how you would get inundated with a culture. I mean, I did it. When I moved to New York City, you know, like, Yankees and Mets, that's a thing, you know, like, that I eventually was going to have to pick a side. You know, I imagine, especially in fucking English football, that's a thing, you know, if you're an Arsenal or Manchester United, I'm sure that that's a big deal. So it's kind of nice that showing that culture being so kind of frivolous and just like around a sports team, whereas contrasted to Real, her view of culture is very entwined with like either trauma or personal, what you think is grief, but ends up being guilt. That's why I think she's strong. Whereas Bull, and that's why I think that the fact that the twist at the end kind of works, because Bull was the one who did it. And so he's, and the movie keeps you blissfully aware. And because of that, it makes Bull almost seem blissfully aware of what he did.
Because I think both of them, I don't think that we are supposed to think we're kind of focusing on Bull and his assimilation and all of that. But I don't think either of them are supposed to be portrayed as having a happy or a healthy response to their new like location. Like, they're both going far too aggressively in each direction. Like, Bull wants to pretend the old things didn't happen. He wants to completely cut out that part of his life. He burns everything they brought. He's like, we're not going to talk about the girl who died or the people who drowned. It is over. We're going to fully jump with both feet into being English. And Rial, like, gets to the point where she almost wants to go back. I mean, she doesn't leave the house she does as little as possible leave the house. I think she wants to, like, live in her trauma, the trauma of, like, not just this girl, but, like, I mean, it's a stand-in for, obviously, these atrocities they saw both in Sudan and on the ocean. And, yeah, I think, obviously, the end is, of course, the meeting place, the healthy meeting place.
Yeah. Well, it's also strange, like, how they externalize the guilt. Because usually when you have survivor's guilt, it's very hard to communicate that to people. Because you get the sense of, like, oh, it's guilt. Great. But in this, because they actually have that a real like thing they should feel guilty about, stealing that child, I think it helps cement it as an actual act that was committed to the audience. And I think by the time you get to the end of the movie, especially the fact that if they would have left that child there, that child would have died, her mom would have died, and the two people that we're following would have died. So the fact that the child died on the trip, it's tragic, but it's also one of those things, like, it would have been dying on that boat, or it would have been dying there. So it was a thing where...
Right. When they were trying to get on the bus, there were people approaching with guns. So
So it was like a
trip. Go ahead. I just wanted to clarify that for the audience.
Yeah. It's just one of those things. It's like, I wouldn't... saying a Sophie's Choice type moment is a little intense, but it was definitely something where you kind of realize that, like, there were no good choices, and the only one they did was to survive, so you eventually have to keep living, right, or you didn't really and survive.
They definitely, like, after they abduct this child, like, it is very clear that they intend to do everything in their power to protect her, to treat her as if she were their own daughter. Like, they're not sociopaths entirely about it. They were desperate and did a desperate act and intended to do the best they could with the cards they were dealt.
Yeah.
So. Right. No, that's that. It's really great because you can see it on the surface being kind of a monstrous act to abduct a child like that. But the way the circumstances unfolded in the movie, he's not monstrous. I mean, can you blame him? Like, the other end of not getting on that bus is a van full of guys with guns. Like, that's so, like, it doesn't make him, it's not the right choice, obviously, but it's an understandable choice. Like, and that's the power of that movie. It relies on that kind of the way it unveils that, and it does it very well. But because again, the witch thing talks to Bull and keeps calling him thief, and you don't, and you keep wondering why, because you haven't seen him steal anything. And it's such a small trick to do, but it worked. It was very effective, very effective.
Yeah. Survivor's guilt's scary. It's a very,
But I will say, I mean, if we could talk about the actual scare factors of the movie, because I feel like, unlike the other, you know, the theme we did for the spooktacular, this one was actually had me kind of crawling in my skin, because like the manifestation for the most part of the movie of the witch is this little girl in this kind of weird leather face kind of mask.
Yeah, it's the daughter, but she's like got this strange mask on.
Right, yeah, and it kind of does the kind of modern trope of kind of like background action in the darkness, and then like suddenly there, suddenly not there, you know, like it does that, but it's very effective with it, and it actually worked. Like,
there's a shot of, I think the first time you kind of get a look at the girl, it's like she runs across a doorway, and she's like a very small figure running directly in front of him across the doorway, and I think my girlfriend had a like physical reaction to that moment. She was definitely frightened by like that particular. Yeah, it's mostly the daughter, and then the other way it manifests is there are drowned corpses that sometimes appear in the house.
That's one of the things that I noticed too. It's like a lot of, I would say that those sequences are all very traditional horror sequences that are all pretty standard. Sure.
It's very Conjuring, very it's like that kind of thing.
I think the one sequence in this that really bounces beyond that, like, because I'm a little bit of a weirdo and I love surrealism, but the thing that I really enjoyed are all of the nightmare sequences that he has, where it's just like this endless sea and bodies rising from the depths. And it's basically, I think it's like the same image type that they used as an inspiration for the cover. Like, if you look this film up on IMDb, the In His House, it's like these two people eating at a table, and there's a wall chunk behind them, and then there's this endless sort of like sea and like clouds and ocean. It almost feels like the void sequences in Under the Skin, where it has such an odd, almost theatrical presentation to it, where it's like someone walking in towards camera and towards the main character from a void, and it's something very unnerving about that. There's something weird about someone wandering towards you from the abyss. So I love those sequences. I thought those are great. I really liked that they had that as his memory of the ocean rather than just splashing water and things like that. Cause that's the trope I always see, is like, it's always, I had a flashback to a nightmare of drowning in the ocean, and it's splash, 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 splash. And this
now
seems
all wet.
Like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's initially very peaceful. Even when he first appears on the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but you're right too, that it is very traditional horror stuff. You know, like one of my favorite sequence, which is very much like you've seen this done 100 times, where he keeps flicking on the lights, flicking off the light, flicking on the light, flicking off a light. Like, that was cool and effective. And sometimes in horror movies, you can lean too easily into tropes and to just cliches. And this movie does that with the mechanism of the spooks, but it doesn't do it with the overall film. The overall film relies very much on character and emotion. But the scary stuff, the supernatural stuff, so to speak, is sort of very much what you would expect in a typical ghost story. You know, in a sort of psychological stuff. I mean, is it real? It bends reality. You know, like that's what it's trying to do to you. Is it real? Is it not real? That's the scary part. It's the unnerving of the audience of you can't tell what's actually happening and what isn't and what's actually in their head or whatever. And that's the spook. That's the real spooky factor of His House.
Do you guys, how do you guys feel about the way in which they used the plot device of them not being able to leave the house? Like, it felt to me like they could have done more, but I was wondering if they did enough for you guys with that. Because the idea of being stuck in a haunted house that you can't leave, like, if I was to just hear that as a brief, I would be very like, ooh, okay, so that's like, you got to spend 24 hours in this haunted house for $1 million. Like, one of those sort of movies. But I'm not saying to go to that extreme, but in this one, do you think that would help it, or do you think that would get in the way of the deeper message?
Well, I don't know, because they kind of go both ways, because you sort of think that, like, this all the surrealism is only happening when they're in the house, but then there's that scene where she walks out, and there's this kid playing soccer, and then she turns a corner, it's the same kid playing the same soccer ball, so it's hard to tell what's actually just contained in the house and what's not. That's where I say it kind of bends it the reality of the movie, and you're kind of disoriented. So I don't know, Borif. I don't know.
Okay. What do you think, Zach?
Yeah, I don't know. I felt it was done. I thought it was perfectly adequately. Yeah, I thought it was, like, obviously physically they can leave the house if they need to, and they do on occasion. So it's not obviously to the extent of, like, literally trapped in an old dark house. But I don't know. I don't think that I just don't think it was, for me, the obviously them being trapped there by the circumstances of their immigration status is, like, effective in terms of, like, the part of the movie that is dealing with that assimilation and that becoming one of the good ones and all that. But I didn't, beyond that, it didn't stick out for me as a plot point of, like, it was a smart way to make it so they weren't just like, hey, there's fucking ghosts here, I'm moving. But beyond that, I didn't think too much about it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do like lean into the punch.
I mean, obviously, I do think that I like the title His House a great deal. I like the ambiguity of that and, like, the different meanings that it has over the course of the movie quite a lot.
What do you think the different meanings are behind that title? Because I was thinking about it, and I was just sort of wondering what the how to interpret His House as a title.
Well, I think that okay. So obviously, one of the movie is about them coming to be more comfortable in this new place and manage their past and their present. So at the end, I think the message is, like, this is finally his house. Like, it has not been his house before. It has been a place where he lived for a time, where he is transient. And at the end, they and all of sort of their trauma, their experiences, their culture, all of that stuff, the people from their past have settled in this new location, and it is finally theirs. But I also think that obviously you could argue the Apeth or whatever it represents being the owner of the house. But
that's
even beyond that, I think that his has a sort of allegorical meaning for literally the UK, like the powers that be in the UK. Like, it is their house that these
they're talking about the king,
in.
You see? His house. It's the king.
Or sort of mess.
They only have a queen, like, right now.
That's right. Have for 50 years.
But yeah, no. I took all three of those as being readings of that particular title.
I kind of agree with that. I leaned in more to the Apeth, like, that's the witch's house, and the Apeth being sort of the agent of malice that is representational of trauma and whatever, you know, like, that's kind of cool. And that's why it's fun that horror movies are a great vehicle for telling these kinds of stories, because A, they're low budget, and B, you usually get a pretty good return. And C,
you can also talk about,
because, but it's because you're kind of cloaking it in this spooktacular movie, it allows you to maybe sneak in more salient messages, like, you know, that maybe we should think about how we treat refugees and everything, which that'll happen. Ha. Anyway, but horror movies are a great vehicle for this. And you're seeing a lot more of it these days, with, like, especially with the success of, like, Get Out and that kind of stuff. Not so much. I mean, I everybody loved Lovecraft Country. I didn't. But I you're seeing more of this kind of stuff, which is groovy. I think it's really cool. And especially this one, because this one, like, it's this is a new talent. You know, this is kind of a debut for, like, a new point of view. And I wish it fair wind.
I guess, yeah. I also say briefly about the His House thing. You know, the title. There's... that line appears several times. That name does appear several times in dialogue, but only in a very specific context of social worker people constantly complaining that, quote, his house is bigger than mine. And I think that, you know, that maybe there's another sort of metaphorical meaning there, in that I think that these people's house, like, there is more, I don't know, they have a deeper, like, more diverse and more difficult cultural and personal history than a lot of these people. Like, I think that there's other ways beyond even the ones that physically talking about the literal house that it could be interpreted. I think it's a good title. I think it's a very strong title.
Well, if I had points, I'd give you both points. But they don't matter.
Well, there's no point. There are no points. Yeah. Yeah, they don't. They don't.
This is our Whose Line Is It Anyway episode. Yeah.
But that helps a little bit, because I was kind of wondering about that.
And you like titles that are real terse, you know, like that evoke enough of a mystery, but, you know, kind of just open the door a little bit, you know. Those are open the door to his house. That's, you know, like, it's cool. And plus, the movie itself intentionally obfuscates a lot, you know, like, it goes out of its way to fuck with the space-time, with the editing and stuff, like, because the part of the big reveal about the daughter, and that's also done with, like, the mood of the whole thing, and even the colors that they use, and even the outfits that they wear. Like, there's a lot of subtext in everything that they're doing, like, and that's why I think that, because it's intentionally putting the wool over your eyes, you're constantly trying to peek behind the curtain. And when you're doing it in a horror movie, you're not sure if you really want to peek behind that curtain. You're not really sure, like, oh, maybe we'll just leave well enough alone and not reach into the hole with the wall with whatever is living in there. Yeah. Maybe just leave it alone.
The other thing that's really that wall, once it has all the holes in it, really, really cool little bit of really, really cool set. I thought that wall looked really great once he had hammered all the holes into it, and it was very effective as a set piece.
It reminded me of every shitty apartment. Yeah. It reminded me of, like, every shitty apartment I've had, where it's like, oh God, why is there a problem with the drywall there? Or, like, any DIY show where they start hammering and, like, pulling things down, and you're like, oh God, this looks terrible. You guys have done a bad job.
Speaking of people who are, like, transplants living in, like, weird sort of hells, the wallpaper definitely reminded me of Barton Fink 100%.
Yeah. Barton Fink. That's right. Yeah. Yep. If I had points, I'd give it to you, because that's exactly what I thought of. But it even... And so when I almost got a chuckle out of it, just because I'm like, Barton Fink. But it does, it happens early on, but it's setting up the mood of this kind of menace that's around.
It's really good. The wallpaper peels down and there's this dark hole behind it. The recent Candyman has a lot of flaws. One of its best sequences also features, like, this hole in the wall. And I think His House is actually a stronger movie than the Candyman sequel reboot thing, but
that's too bad.
Yeah,
I haven't seen that one yet. I was hoping that one was gonna be good.
It's got good moments, but it doesn't totally hang together. It's also very short. But yeah,
I mean, that's true of a lot of horror films. If it's got a couple good set pieces, I'll probably be okay. It's very much like the corollary in horror for comedy for Police Academy, where as long as you have a couple good set pieces, you got me for the movie. I think we talked about that, right? Where it was like it was a stage piece where you had to have a couple good sequences and then everything else was just strung together.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, I mean, the problem
here we
is
are
that,
talking about a good movie and you got to go bring up Police Academy.
Well, I mean, the thing is with Candyman, it's a slasher movie, right?
Yeah.
So it is what it is. Like it's very much a creature of its own design. You can get a little bit away from that to talk about real cultural stuff, but at the same time, you're going to be seeing a lot of people get slashed.
I'll also say another film that His House reminded me of is a film. I don't know if you guys, there's a movie about a monster that has later became a gay icon.
Babadook.
The Babadook.
Babadook.
Yeah, there is elements of the ending where that very much remind me of the Babadook. Like, because I think that ending of the ending of His House is, I think, really, really strong. I think it's one of the best things in that these figures, these ghosts that have been haunting them and terrorizing them. The final shot is them in the house and all of these ghosts are there with them, but they no longer look massacred or drowned and they're no longer aggressive. And they're in the daylight and they seem like peaceful. And I think that image is really great. That the ultimate resolution of this was not to exorcise these things from their past, but to find a place for them to live alongside them. Like, I think that's just a really, 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 and they don't say it, obviously, they do it exclusively through that image, but I thought it was a really erudite and economical bit of storytelling and theme just in that last shot.
And also wholly earned. You know, I think part of the problem when it kind of ends in this kind of, I don't want to say rosy, but in the end, they end up okay. Problem with those kind of endings, especially in horror movies, is it does seem kind of like cliche that they survived or whatever, like, or that just kind of shoehorned into a happy ending. I always thought about like the original Friday the 13th would have ended a lot better if they just ended where Jason pulls it. Spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it, when Jason pulls her in from the boat and just roll credits. But then she ends up, they do the psycho trick where they end up in a hospital and I'd rather have,
who was the boy?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why that's sort of like kind of letting everybody off the hook. You know, with this one, that ending, even though it, like I said, it's not really a happy ending, but it's an acceptance almost. It's earned. This is an earned thing that they both had to give up something to get to where they are.
Mm-hmm. I'd say that in this film, it plays differently. Like, people mention the Babadook and I have seen it, but I always have had issues with the ending of the Babadook and kind of how the Babadook handles things. Like, I think I might have not been the right audience for it, but a lot of the way in which the mother reacts to the child at the end of that movie, I find very overwrought and a little hammy, and I have never been able to like readjust. But I will say that in this film, it felt very earned when they come to a emotional conclusion. People didn't do as many histrionics in this movie, which I appreciated. It was like
not at
very,
all
very straightforward acting and very like grounded is what I would say. Like, that's one of the things that I liked about this one and I didn't like about the Babadook, because I liked the concept of the Babadook, but specifically the sequence in the Babadook where the lady goes, "I am your mother," I had a really hard time with. So in this one, having all the conversations be very calm and having them between two people who I believed in the movie loved each other. Those two characters really do care about each other. And it just goes to the acting ability of both of them to make me go, oh, okay, these, like, all the horror is happening, but they haven't lost sight of the fact that they really care about each other, which I think is very helpful in horror films, because that can get lost sometimes.
And I think it is very
And to your credit, that's not, and to your credit, to the movie's credit, it's not overwrought. You know, that implication of their feelings towards one another is told explicitly through the acting. And I think that that's remarkable.
And I think that so much of like the underlying aspects of the story are done with a degree of like subtlety that make them really work. Like, even everything about how this is like very, we've all agreed this is a story about assimilation. And there's times that's a little more explicit in time, but like their attitudes towards it are often very like, you know, like it's not super, super, super over the top. Like, there's stuff like the utensils or the way that, or even how Bull adapts to like exposing his own, you know, history, his own culture to this place. Like when he first goes to the place after being tormented by the Apeth, he's like, he accidentally mentions something about the Apeth and everybody stares at him. He's like, no, 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 that's not what I meant. Obviously it's rats or something. It's rats. And then at the end, when Matt Smith comes back, he's openly like, we killed the witch. Like he doesn't pretend anymore that like this thing from their culture, this Apeth is like, he doesn't hide it anymore from him because I think he is in a place where he is more secure with his own culture and and displaying that culture.
That's a good read.
Yeah.
Good
yeah. Read, it also, Zach. It makes sense because it's also one of those moments where he's like, you know, it seems to me like the character is willing to be open about the things culturally that don't translate. And he no longer cares in the same way he did originally. Like he's not terrified he's going to be kicked out of the country for believing in a witch.
Yeah.
So even though that's a strange belief, the house is not damaged in the way it was. They seem like they're being very helpful and working with the system. So, you know, if I was like Matt Smith going through the stuff, I'd be like, all right, well, they had an issue and they seem like they're back to normal. I guess everyone's going to go get a job when they're out of this. And that's a pretty straightforward ending for that character.
He is very much like that at the very beginning where he's like, oh, it needs a little bit of dusting, you know, just a, you know, a little bit of spit shine and this place will be spruced right up, you know?
Are you seeing this place
with your eyeballs?
He's definitely, I would say he feels to me like a writer insert character a little bit. Like the writers,
that's, you know,
if I'm not mistaken, the writers are white people on this. The director is I believe he's a black man from similar region, but I'm not sure where he's from exactly, but
I think he is just from Britain. I think he's like an English guy. He was born in England.
Okay. I mean, he probably has like more of a cultural background to pull from on that. Was just a thing I noticed, that it seemed like that particular character has the same introduction that I think a lot of people like us would have, where you're hearing this story for the first time, you're like, this is odd. I don't know what a house witch is. I don't know what the concept of a house witch is, and I don't know why you're banging holes in your walls. This is a strange thing to do first thing out of the gate. So I think having him there to kind of set that up is like, I don't understand what's happening, kind of helped cement and introduce the world to everybody else who wouldn't know what's happening.
I think that's fair. And I think, you know, in most horror movies, you know, most of the good ones at least, characters are as deep as they need to be, you know. Yeah. Like I recently made Sarah watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and it's not like any of the main characters are all that deep. You don't really learn anything about them. It doesn't really matter. They're just victims.
But fucking Franklin, though, that guy's a piece of shit.
Fucking Franklin. Who,
I don't
who
remember
signed
Franklin.
To break a guy with a wheelchair.
Oh,
he's the guy in the wheelchair.
But
even him, that's the only characterization you get out of anybody in that movie, is that they're all kind of wild, crazy teenagers, and they brought along their little brother who's annoying. That's it. But that's all you really need in a movie like that, you know. But the important part, especially with Sally, the lone survivor in the movie, you may not have really been familiar with who she was, but by the end of the movie, you know what she is now. Like, you've got a good idea of what she's going to have to live with for the rest of her life, you know. Like, that's the trick of the movie. And with this movie, with Matt Smith's character, that's, I think you're right, Borf, that it is sort of like insert character there, that this is the writers kind of like trying to use as a device to open up the world for the audience. But it's also he's got his own sense of malice and menace, even if it is sort of like benign and ambivalent. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a cool trick that it does. And there's, like, Zach brought it up specifically in The Office, where there's that moment of silence where everybody looks at him as soon as he says witch doctor, and everyone just kind of looks at him and be like, what? And Matt Smith's face, he kind of like looks around, because you get the sense that Matt Smith thinks he's one of the good ones, right? Like, this system might be monstrous, but I'm not a monster. See, mm-hmm. I go out of my way to do barely anything at all. You know, so I think that that's the appropriate device for Matt Smith's character, and it does well. And like I said, you can tell he took a pay cut because this movie was not expensive.
I don't know if he took that much of a pay cut. I think he is a solid English actor.
Okay, so a good chunk of the salary went to...
I'm just saying, like, he's an English actor. They will show up.
Yeah, very much so, right?
I think we have cleared that one up looking at the other English actors we've seen over the course of this show.
Christopher
they
Lee.
Just show up.
Oh, right, oh, that's yeah. right. That's right.
I mean, you know.
Is there a paycheck? I'll be there.
I mean, like, I think it's very, very much like there's that very famous Michael Caine story where he says, I've never seen Jaws 3, but I mm-hmm. saw the house the money bought. Yeah. Or something.
That's right.
Something like yep. lines.
And
yeah.
Yep. That said, that's I will say that this true. Is one of the better Matt Smith movies he's made, because he's been in like
yeah.
right after he did, you know, Doctor Who. Everybody was like, let's throw him in a bunch of random shit, and he was in a bunch of random
yeah.
shit, mm-hmm. and he always was in bad random shit. Where you're like, oh, why are you in this? Mm. You don't need to be in this Terminator shit. You can do something else, Matt Smith.
Well, and then he landed The Crown, and that kind of, you know.
I mean,
that,
yeah, that no, that's yeah. great. I haven't seen The Crown. I don't. I'm aware
yeah.
it's about the royals.
It's very much like Downton Abbey in that it sets up that a lot of turmoil might happen and then doesn't.
And that's very much
The Crown.
I'll say this for a couple things about for Matt Smith. One, like when he's in bad stuff, like my dad loves zombie films, so when Pride and Prejudice and Zombies came out, he rented it and I watched it with him. And Matt Smith was the best part of that movie, legitimately. Like, he was very good. He went for it with that movie. I'll also say this, poor guy, best movie he's ever been in, he got cut out of, because he got cut out of In Bruges, which I think is a very good movie. But yeah.
They didn't even throw in a director's cut? Oh man.
He played a young version of Ralph Fiennes' character in that movie in a flashback, I believe.
Cool.
Wow.
Yeah. That's cool. Oh man.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Wow.
Oh man, that would have been great.
I think you can find the clip online.
Okay, cool. I'll have to look that up because that's cool.
Yep.
In Bruges is a surprisingly
good
movie.
I like that movie a lot. I like that movie a lot. Ralph Fiennes specifically is really good in that movie. But to Matt Smith, look, I'm a Doctor Who fan. You know, I'm not going to make any bones about it. I loved him as Doctor Who, even though I loved the previous Doctor probably a bit more. But you know, you have to say this about Matt Smith as Doctor Who. He's the one that made it its global phenomenon that it is. It never got as popular until Matt Smith came on board. But, you know, as far as an actors go, he's what he's got is these kind of like boyish charm, you know, and it works really well for like him playing the Crown, because he plays Prince Philip, who's kind of a piece of shit. And very brash and just arrogant. And Matt Smith can play that well. While still being kind of charming and this kind of boyish pluck to it. And it works really well for this movie, because again, he's patting himself on the back every night saying like, I am doing my part to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and
he plays it well.
And, I agree. I think
audience, I just want to point out one thing that just happened, because if you're listening, you couldn't see it, but in person, Zach just started fondling a knife on camera. And immediately became 90% more threatening. Like, Carlson's just casually saying how much he loves
miles
Matt
apart.
Smith, and I just see like Zach's.
Right. We've been doing some Halloween crafts. And I've been
is
like,
is that
having
what
to
you call
some...
murder now? Halloween
no,
crafts.
We got a little ghost guy. We got a little ghost guy that we're making for the yard.
Your murder
so
crafts.
Had,
okay.
So we've got some knife out for Halloween. Halloween based crafts.
That's nice, because you got your little white ghost and you've got your knife. You're gonna save Bull from assimilation. You know,
exactly.
Just cut that ghost's throat. And, you know, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all thematic. No, I agree. I think Matt Smith is a very charming actor. I prefer both David Tennant and Peter Capaldi to Matt Smith, but I do. Yeah. He's always good. I enjoy him in the things I've seen him in. He always seems to be giving it his all, and I'm glad that he got to be in a good project.
Yeah, well, now he's going to be Daemon Targaryen in the new Game of Thrones, so that's a thing.
Everybody's looking forward to more.
Well,
Game
here's
of
what I'll say.
Thrones.
At least this story's finished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, the world's clamoring for more of it. I mean, yeah. Anyway, that's why my favorite part about Game of Thrones is Kit Harington, who played Jon Snow, is like, I'm never doing anything like this. And then Marvel comes around and like, well, how would you like to play the Black Knight? How much money are you offering? Ah, Knight gathers and whatever, you know, let's go.
Yeah.
Whereas like Peter Dinklage, I think is like, if he never has anything associated with Game of Thrones or him ever again, I'll think he'll die a happy man.
He's,
he's about to get nominated for an Oscar Cyrano de Bergerac for that Cyrano now. Movie.
Yeah.
Hey, good choice. Excellent choice.
Yeah.
Excellent.
There you go. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, gentlemen, I guess that is his house. I think unless we got anything else to add about, I gotta say, Zach, you rewarded us this time with your bonus movie. I mean, unlike Border, which was last year's bonus movie, this was actually a joyous,
Border
occasion.
Was a interesting movie. I'm not gonna say it was definitely the most.
It wasn't bad, but it wasn't
right.
It's an acquired
I didn't enjoy. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. What I'll say about his house.
Hey,
compared
I remember Border at least. Will always remember.
Oh
Border.
Yeah, no, it's there. It's in the databanks now. Can't forget it now. But I will say that what I liked about his house, more than Border, which is quite a bit, is that again how economical it is, and it doesn't really waste a lot of time. Whereas I felt we were meditating a lot with Border.
It's okay.
But
we
yeah,
don't
no,
have
this
to,
was a fun, spooky. This is a good one. Movie to cap off a Halloween theme, man. Good job. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess I guess that's mostly my final thoughts, that this is a good movie, and I think that for a horror movie, you should probably, it's the time of the year, I would say give this movie a watch.
I'd say that so the one thing we didn't talk about as much is that this movie is actually recommended to me by previous guest on this show and co-host on my other show, Brian
the
Flynn.
Great Brian.
This movie came out last Halloween on October 30th or 31st, 2020. I heard fucking zero about this movie, even though it has really, like, it's 100% positive reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, well-received, all that stuff. Nothing about this movie. Like, and it was on Netflix. It's still on Netflix. It's like an extremely accessible movie. Anybody out there, you can watch this thing probably right now for 95% of our audience. And I just can't believe how under the radar this flew for how quality it was, and how interesting the subject matter was, and it's, you know, obviously it's a black director and creator, like that sort of thing is often heralded, especially when it's a quality product, and this one just didn't.
That is
didn't.
True, man. I mean, it reminded me of like when we watched Blindspotting in the early days of the podcast. Yeah. That, like, how good that movie was, you would think I would have heard more about it. And yeah, I totally agree about this. Especially horror movies are a very insular, you know, kind of navel gazing audience. You know, so you'd think that something like this would kind of get around. But yeah, I haven't heard shit about this movie.
The thing is, I have a feeling this one might get revisited later because I think these actors are all very solid actors that are going to get more well known. But I think it also,
think
just to be
true.
Totally honest, last year Halloween sucked. Like, there was no good news. Like, I was so fucking distracted by the fact that we couldn't go outside. And I think you actually talked about how it was like a
scary election going on.
It was the perfect Halloween. It was a full moon
Halloween.
Saturday. Yeah, it was the perfect Halloween. We couldn't. And yeah, we were staring down the barrel of that election, and that was a frightening prospect.
Yeah. Like, right. I think to be real, this one, it's a good movie, but it's emotionally heavy. And I don't think I or anybody else that I knew would have been ready emotionally to watch something like this that had real stuff to say about the stuff that we were seeing just getting tossed around like tossed salad in the fucking political spectrum.
I'm certainly hoping that these actors, but this director, like, I could easily see these people having like some real interesting work ahead of them, getting discovered by and large, and this movie becoming like, did you guys ever see his first movie? Like, and people slowly discovering it in that way.
Well, the Sope,
I wish him fair wind, you know.
Risu guy's really, really impressive. Like, I've seen him in other stuff.
I agree.
I remember him actually from an old show called Humans. Which was okay. It was basically a thing where he played an android who was like becoming It's a whole thing. We don't need to get onto it, but it's a show about androids becoming real people. I enjoyed some of it. His parts were pretty good. There are a lot of actors who came from that and have been in a bunch of genre stuff, but I'm excited to see what this guy does next. I'm excited to see what everybody does next.
Yeah, especially the director. Fair wind, dude, because you know.
He doesn't have anything listed as upcoming on his IMDb yet, but he did get a lot of recognition for this, so I'm guessing that there is. I'm guessing there's things going on behind the scenes with
you. I do wonder how much this film is going to be revisited as we go on, because like it reminds me of the not Margot Kidder, but the other lady in Black Christmas,
Olivia Hussey.
Yes, I'm not 100% sure. She was in a movie with Steve Martin, and when she came on set, Steve Martin straight up told her that, like, "Oh my God, you're in my favorite movie," and she assumed, "Oh, Romeo and Juliet," because that's what everyone knows. He's like, "No, Black Christmas. That movie rules." I wonder how much of that's going to happen with his house, because this is a quality movie, and again, it's emotionally heavy. It's not a easy movie to watch, but it's a brief movie. Like, you will through it.
It's economical. Yeah. The storytelling is not too in your face or overblown. The spooky sequences are effectively spooky. Yeah,
right. It's not pretentious. You know, it's not up its own ass. Yeah. Like, it's quality film.
Yep.
All right. Well.
So yeah, I guess
we're on to the next.
I guess that's
bit
our
then,
final
right?
thoughts and. Yeah, that's right. We have finished the funzos, and now we're back to the grindstone, where we are going to be doing my theme of sports movies, because here we are. It's October now. This is back when I worked in sports television. This is the busiest sports. Fall is always the busiest sports month. You've got all the seasons starting in all that. You've got baseball postseason. Football's in full effect. Everything's happening in sports. That's what everybody's going to be noting. And you're leading up to Thanksgiving. That's what pretty much anybody is going to be talking about or doing. Yeah, so we are going to be doing sports movies. That's right. So sports movies is the theme. The movie that I have chosen that we've definitely revisited, that's definitely going to be a revisit for Borup and I, is the movie Slapshot with Paul Newman.
Okay.
So tune in next time. Note, our episodes are now coming out on Sunday, so don't look for them on Fridays no more.
So we'll be doing these three. The next three will be sports movies. Then it's our annual Christmas bonus to be released on Boxing Day with our new Sunday release schedule instead of its previous release slot of Christmas Eve. But
Oh, yeah, we should have announced that up front, probably, that it's coming out on Sundays now, not on Fridays. Anybody who's listening who found out about this show because of Chuckle Sandwich, hello. It's nice to chat with you. Y'all seem like some swell kids. Please don't burn down our house. Thank you.
Burn down his house. Anyway.
Yes.
So I guess on that note, we could wrap up. This was fun, and we'll see you guys next time for... The very 70s grossness of Slapshot. With that, I have been Russell Carlson. I was joined by Chris Bora.
All I can taste is the metal.
I was also joined by Zach Powers.
I'm one of the good ones.
Thank you for joining us. And as we always say here on the Movie Trap, Diane Ladd is too young to be Chevy Chase's mom.
That's the Movie Trap promise.
See you guys.